Focus with Jessica Strutt on ABC Radio Perth.
Good morning, Jess Strutt here. Thanks for joining me for Focus. I don't know if you remember whining at your mum about having to do chores or homework. There were seven little struts at my house, and all of us whinging why at our poor mum, who would often respond, "Because I said so." Take out the garbage. Why? Because I said so. Eat your vegetables. Why? Because I said so. And what every mother knows, but is quite simply too exhausted to say, is it's because it's for the good of all of us. Because you're part of a family and you need to pull your weight. Because one day you will thank me for this. Yesterday we had a message delivered to us, a pretty bleak one, by the UN from an exhausted Mother Nature. Unless we begin to pull our weight, change our behaviour and work together, things are going to fall apart at the seams. And I don't know about you, but it feels like the first domino fell a long time ago. And as they collapse in neat succession, it's easy to feel like it's a process we can't stop. But I think you figure this out now. Sitting back and watching is not really my style. This gorgeous city of ours is built on a biodiversity hotspot. There are only 35 of those in the world. And I expect that yesterday's bleak news was no surprise to our guests today. Protecting our World Heritage biodiversity here in Perth. That's our focus today.
This is Focus with Jessica Strutt on ABC Radio Perth.
Now, as I just said, we're going to talk about ways you can help to protect our biodiversity. Maybe you are already doing this. Are you involved in a local group looking after a nearby wetland or bushland? And what does it involve? Do the kids in, you know, at your school, do they get involved? Do they go on frog counts, parrot counts? I want to know what we can do, what you do. The number 1-300-222-720 or 0437-922-720 is the text line you can get me on. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Joining us today on this topic, Dr. Julian Bolitar. He is the Acting Director of the Australian Urban Design Research Centre here at the University of Western Australia and Professor of Biodiversity at UWA, Stephen Hopper, who's joining us from the ABC's studios in beautiful Albany. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Stephen, as I mentioned earlier, this UN report paints a very bleak picture of just how many of the world's species are now under threat of extinction. How are we tracking more specifically here in our own backyard in WA?
Jess, we're in line with the global trend, would be the summary. We have special responsibilities here that you've emphasised because of the incredible richness of plants and animals that particularly southwestern Australia has. It was the first Australian global biodiversity hotspot recognised in 2000 in a paper in the journal Nature. And that's sounds pretty good, but it's actually an accolade with a sting in the tail because it's a place that's rich in endemic species, but where they're really concentrated and under threat.
Now, I know you spoke to my colleagues Nadia and Russell yesterday briefly on the Brekkie program, but not everyone would have been listening. So can you run through with us some of the most well-known local animal and plant species here in our backyard that are under threat?
You can start with some of the most conspicuous. So,
okay, indeed, let's do that.
And indeed challenging. So black cockatoos, for example.
All right, beautiful. We all know those. Tick.
Yeah,
you know
beautiful
those ones?
Birds.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Love them.
It was a bit of a surprise yesterday to Russell and Nadia that I mentioned quokkas, given their predominance with the great selfie craze that's happening at Rottnest. They're among many of the mammals that are threatened. So they occur not only on Rotto, but they occur on the mainland. Top of the Stirling Range, Walpole, places like that. And the state's faunal emblem, the numbat, is critically endangered, of course. That was once widespread right across southern Australia, semi-arid Australia, and persisted in this wonderful refuge, we call it, of the southwest, where many things have resisted extinction but are now faced with incredible pressures, as the Global Report emphasises.
Bit sad, really. We like to get a selfie with these, and I think I've even seen a selfie with a mainland quokka. So we like to get a selfie with them, but we just don't seem to be worrying too much about looking after them. What about in terms of the plant species in terms of Western Australia? How are we tracking there? What are some of the ones that people might be familiar with that are, you know, more at risk than others, Stephen?
Yep. Well, if I can start globally, that there's 400,000 species of flowering plants worldwide, and a fifth of them are threatened, 20%. Australian flora has 14% of the world's total, and Western Australia has 7%, has half of that, 7%. So we've got hundreds of threatened plants in this global biodiversity hotspot, and Perth itself has some right under our noses. Many of them are displayed in King's Park, so you can go up and see them, but it includes things like banksias, some of the kangaroo paws, eucalypts, acacias, spider orchids, your favourite, I know.
Yes, you know, yes. Just I let that slip yesterday when I was chatting with you, didn't I? I do love a spider orchid.
Yeah, and there's tremendous diversity. That's what this place is remarkable for. Tremendous persistence of wildflowers. And, the challenge is that a lot of these now are threatened as human land uses, climate change, dieback disease, fire regimes, alien species sort of bear upon us.
More on that in a moment. It's 11 minutes past 10 with Jess Strutt on the Focus program. We're talking about WA's biodiversity today, and it's on the back of a very bleak, sad and confronting report from the UN that a million species worldwide, plant, animal, are under threat of extinction. And so we're taking a good look at how we're tracking here in Perth. Beautiful state, lots of beautiful animals and plants, but are we looking after them? Speaking today to Dr. Julian Bolliter. He's an acting director of the Australian Urban Design Research Centre at UWA, and also joining us from Albany, the Albany ABC Studios, is Professor of Biodiversity at UWA, Stephen Hopper. Stephen, you spoke yesterday on Brekkie, and you mentioned this quiet catastrophe, your words, that's been going on for a long time unnoticed. Why? Why has that been allowed to happen? How did that happen, this quiet catastrophe?
I guess the global trend, which is really emphasised in the international report, emphasises... Sorry, I'm getting a little bit of interference from in my headphones from somewhere else.
And we can come back and try another line if we need to.
That's all right. Yeah, I can hear you, but I can hear someone else also talking to me, so
okay.
Might be best to go to another question.
All right, we'll move on. We'll come back to that. We'll just try and fix that up with Stephen there. Dr. Julian Bolliter, the report says that human use of land and sea resources are mostly to blame. In WA, what is going wrong in respect to the use of the land?
Okay, well, unlike Stephen, I can only really talk to the urban dimension of this, which is how urbanisation and biodiversity interact. And we've had a long-running problem in Perth, which is that we have a sprawling city form, and the desire for having a house on its own block of land remains the kind of dream in Perth very much. 79% of people, if unrestricted by budget, would say that having their own house on their own block of land is what they would aspire to. And it's very hard to stand in the way of such desires. We are a democracy after all.
Consumer demand, yeah, that's right.
So the overall effect of that is Perth is one of the most sprawled cities on the planet. It's the second most sprawled city in Australia. And while we are trying to do infill development, there is still significant suburban sprawl happening on the fringe. And the issue for us in Perth is, unfortunately, where much of the remnant vegetation is, such as on the coastal northern development front, is also where people want to live. We have cleared land in the southeast, for instance, but that doesn't tend to be so much where people want to live. And it's very difficult to reconcile suburban development and the complex and fragile ecology of the Swan Coastal Plain.
So effectively, I mean, we speak a lot on Focus here about urban sprawl. We've done a focus on McMansions. So listeners are aware of these issues. So effectively what you're saying is we're not that great at development. We're not really the model for suburbia here in Perth.
No, I don't think we are, but we should be, because of these 35 biodiversity hotspots around the world have many of the rapidly growing cities of the world, and we don't have really the models by which you can reconcile urban development and biodiversity. And Perth should lead the way on this. We have a strong governance system, we have a strong planning system, we're wealthy, and we can resource the kind of research which would enable us to reconcile these two otherwise and opposing kind of things. So we should lead the way. I don't think we currently are, though.
To be clear, though, so we've got the brains. We've got researchers such as yourself and others. There's no shortage of brains here to do it. What's holding us back then? Is it a funding issue? You're saying we're a wealthy state, but are we putting the money into this that we ought to be?
Perhaps not, but I think there is a tremendous path dependency to cities and how they evolve. There's a lot of momentum in the system. There's a lot of land which has been signed off for urban development for many years, and it's very difficult to stand in front of the bulldozer, which is the path dependency of a city. It's very hard to change things. Developers have a very specific model that they pursue in outer suburban developments, which they know works. And as a result of that, they are not inclined to begin tinkering at that model if they don't need to. From their perspective, they have one already and it works. So it's this path dependency of urban development is very difficult to halt or indeed transform in new directions.
I've been asking you this morning what you're doing in your own local backyard to do your bit. And because we're going to look at that later, if you're interested in this, are there ways you can help? And I've been asking people today, what do they do? Are they involved in a little group? Do they go and do cocky counts? Do you go out and do counts of frogs? There's so much you can do. And I have already got a fair few texts through. So let me just read a few of those out. Hi, Jessica. I count quenders every year for the WWF study, World Wildlife Fund, and I have been for many years. I live in Darlington in the Perth Hills, and when I started, we had almost no quenders in the garden. I've planted lots of low protective shrubs, and local people seem to be keeping their pets under control now. So we have a pleasing population increase, and I see lots of young quenders and females with babies in their pouches. Cheers, Suzanne, I think. Thank you for that text. Obviously, I'm originally from Darlington. I also love quenders and do see them sometimes run over, and it makes you really sad. So it's good to know some people are out there, including yourself, are helping the local population. This one from Claire: developers are pushing to clear large sites in the hills where I live, around Stoneville and Parkerville, for urbanisation. We are fighting this. The hills are unique in flora and wildlife, with black cockies and eagles, amazing biodiversity. We will keep pushing back for sustainable growth to preserve the Perth Hills. Claire, good to hear all the Perth Hills folk, people from my hood, listening in. Claire, we actually did a whole special on the urban sprawl that's being planned for the hills, so you can go back on our website and take a look at that one if you missed it. Philippa says, why not plant our beautiful native flora along the Swan River to help the native birds and fish, as well as make Perth a magnet for tourists to see our unique landscape? Get rid of the fake California look, says Philippa. Fantastic. Thanks for your text. Please keep them coming. There's a bit of history here, isn't there, Julian, to the fact that where we are developing. I saw some of the pieces you've written, including for The Conversation. Can you run us through that? We've never really been that great at deciding, you know, where we should develop and what our local biodiversity aspects are.
Yeah, indeed. And I think there's been an unprecedented effort in the last 5 years or so, which occurred under the previous government, which was called the Green Growth Plan, which was all about bringing together developers and designers and ecologists to understand what Perth's future urban footprint should be and how that could be reconciled, where we should be protecting species, where we should be making new conservation reserves. There was 170,000 hectares of new conservation reserves proposed, and where we can do suburban development on cleared land, which might be old agricultural land, for instance. So that was an unprecedented effort to really resolve the issues we're talking about today. But unfortunately, that seems to be stalled, and I think would be worth further journalistic investigation.
Thanks for the tip. We'll have a look at that one on a future focus, I reckon, Julian. I think we've got Stephen back. Stephen, are you there?
I am.
Oh, thank
indeed,
goodness.
Yes.
It was going to be a pretty difficult hour without one of our experts, because as much as I love this issue, I'm certainly no expert. What are some of the other major threats? I think you sort of touched on them in passing, but what are some of the other major threats to our biodiversity? Julian's just covered off while we lost you on land clearing. You know, can you Can you talk us through some of the invasive species, you know, feral animals? What else is causing this to happen?
Yeah, there's a big list of six or seven major threats, and the ones that are really pertinent to Perth and to the southwest. Five of them are mentioned in the international report. So, changes in land use and sea use, fundamental. Then direct exploitation of organisms. So this is harvesting animals and plants for commercial or other uses. Climate change, pollution, invasive alien species, inappropriate use of fire, and dieback disease is a major issue here in the southwest and pertains to Perth. So that's the gamut. In terms of invasive species, dieback stands out. There's 8,000 species of native plants in the southwest region from Shark Bay to Israelite Bay and everywhere coastwards from there. And about 3,000 species are susceptible to this disease. On a global scale, it's the worst pan-endemic that we have in terms of plant disease affecting wild species.
People who walk in the hills might be familiar or the southwest with dieback because the signs, they see the signs, but not everyone might be clear about what it is. Can you explain it in simple layman's terms for us?
Yeah, it's sort of related to a fungus. It's a soil-borne organism that breeds and grows especially in warm, moist soil. And naturally the control for it is to avoid transporting warm, moist soil or transporting infected plants through nurseries and that sort of thing. So it's great in the sense, I think, that it really focuses each of us on what we can do as individuals. So just with home gardens, for example, making sure that you get dieback-free soil if you import soil into your garden. Fundamental, otherwise, you know, major things like banksias just will cark it.
is that well, and obviously we're not going to talk brands, but is that well labelled on when you're going out to nurseries to buy this stuff?
I don't know the answer to that, but I'm sure reputable nurseries certainly make a point of emphasising that they have strict plant hygiene.
Okay.
So just ask, I think, is the best way for listeners to work out that one. It's emblematic of major thing. The invasive weeds is another one. When I was looking after Kings Park, we were spending, in the 1920s, veldgrass was introduced as a revenue-raising exercise by the Kings Park Board of the day. Those were the days of horses, of course, and just phasing out. But when I was running Kings Park for 12 years in the 90s into the early 2000s, noughties, we were spending $30,000 a year trying to get rid of veldgrass because it was just smothering the understory of the banksia and eucalypt woodlands. So things like kangaroo paws and your favourites, the orchids, were just didn't have a chance against this pernicious weed.
I'm glad you got rid of that then. I want to save those spider orchids.
Yeah, yeah. It can be done. You know. So in amongst all this doom and gloom, I think we need to focus, and I'm sure we'll do more as we talk about solutions as well.
Before we lost you, I just wanted to go back a little bit.
Yep.
The quiet catastrophe, you're talking about why, but how big, and you've now sort of run through with, you know, some of the factors, but how big an issue is this lack of funding? Because Julian and I sort of touched on that while we lost you. How big an issue is that in terms of the funding, in terms of monitoring and research here in Western Australia?
Yeah, well, in my career, which started in the 70s, so I'm a bit long in the tooth now. I've focused on this area throughout the career. And the 70s were a time of considerable hope in the environmental area. It was when the EPA was first set up in WA, and then they went through a process called the Conservation Through Reserves Review to look at reservation, which Julian has mentioned, you know, is still happening. It's being repeated every generation almost, every 10 years or so, in metropolitan Perth. It's been done in the past, and ultimately the whole challenge boils down to the value systems that we hold as a mainstream community. The pressures are away from immersing in nature and getting to know and love and care for nature to deal with the day-to-day pressures of city living worldwide.
It's a really good point. Julian, are we a little complacent about this stuff? I mean, to the untrained eye, we might not actually realise what a biodiversity hotspot looks like.
Yeah, I think for too long, to the untrained eye, indeed, much of the Swan Coastal Plain vegetation, particularly the kind of coastal scrub, can appear to be just scrub. And I think we're emerging out of a long period where the kind of public knowledge around different vegetation types and the Swan Coastal Plain more generally was pretty thin. So we tended to characterise it as just being scrub. And you know, once it's cleared, we'll turn it into something proper, which is housing and parks with trees. And I think the kind of collective intelligence around that stuff is increasing. But in terms of urban development and its effects on biodiversity, I think the problem has been that the fringe of the city is not easily conceptualised by the average Perth resident. Which is a very ambiguous kind of terrain. So we get a lot of focus on things like Elizabeth Quay and the demolition of that slice of turf for Elizabeth Quay, and we see that the kind of controversy that ensued with that. We don't tend to see that same controversy on the development front on the edge of the city, and I think it's because it's not as easily conceptualised for people. And it does.
Great point. I'd never thought of that. But it's a bit out of sight, out of mind a little then.
Yeah.
When we're cutting down the Moreton Bay figs near Elizabeth Quay, we're outraged.
Sure.
When we're hitting our beautiful natives down there.
And I think also the land we're sprawling into is not a giant carry forest. And so sometimes the importance of it is not immediately evident to the eye. So I think we need to kind of, as citizens, try and reconceptualise the city and to be more focused on those edges, because that's where the action really is.
Beautiful points. I hadn't thought of that, and I think a lot of people listening today will really start rethinking that point. In an article you wrote for The Conversation, you said that between 2001 and 2009, suburban growth consumed an annual average of 851 hectares of highly biodiverse land on the urban fringe. Are we turning that around at all?
Yeah, look, I think that was a particularly bad decade.
It's shocking.
We are turning it around in the sense that greenfield, which means outer suburban development conditions, are very bad at the moment. So that helps us. But the fact that this green growth plan, which should be managing this fringe peri-urban situation, appears to have been stalled, is certainly worrying in that respect. I think some good moves have been made, and I think the work that's been done for that project is highly important, and it's important that that project springs back to life again, because it is essential.
Some texts here, so I want to read them because I've been asking you, what do you do? Are you involved in a local group that helps out? Someone sent me a wonderful picture of some numbats. Hi, I'm from a small group called the Numbat Task Force. WA species are in trouble. If you look at the 2020 Species Plan A, a federal level for Australia's mammals, we have the numbat, brush-tailed betong. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Am I, Stephen? Hope so.
Betong.
Oh, sorry. Gilbert's potoroo. Western ring-tailed possum and the western quoll, all on the list. We don't give our unique species the attention they need, and successive governments have let our environment down. Until we, the voting public, make it a priority, nothing will change. Thank you, Rob, for that text. Someone has told me that there's a special farm up Mushay Way that specialises in native plants, if that's what you want to do in your own garden, which of course helps. This one have worked for over 59 years to protect biodiversity, only to watch the government declare urban zoning in parts of the recognised bush biodiversity areas, namely the Perth Hills. Cannot do blanket urban zoning without recognition of fragile environment. Currently, it's a one-size-fits-all policy for the Perth Pill madness, says Sharon in Mount Helena. Thanks for listening in. I went to school out there. Beautiful spot.
This is Focus on ABC Radio Perth.
I just want to quickly touch on the impact of tourism. Tourism, a key focus here of this government, and we really love getting out and enjoying our wilderness, don't we, Stephen? But are we doing enough in terms of, I suppose, finding the right balance in ecotourism and tourism, but still protecting our biodiversity?
Short answer is, Jess, we really need to lift our game in this area if we're serious about caring for biodiversity. Perth is one of the richest cities on the planet in terms of plant life. It's right up there with Cape Town, with Rio and Sydney, among the leaders that have, you know, thousands of species of native plants within the metropolitan boundaries. And a recent study on threatened plants Australia-wide that was published just in the last 6 months established that there is an emerging threat being posed that was previously unrecognised among the list of major concerns that are causing the global decline in threatened species and the Australian decline, and that was tourism and recreation. The challenge is that for tourism to be prosecuted in a way that generates dollars, it often involves creating the five-star hotel, the swimming pool, in beautiful settings, but essentially destroying part of the asset that ecotourists want to come and see. Not all ecotourism does that, of course. There are sensitive approaches to do this, and many shining examples of that. But you know, the risk is that you just get development essentially for people who can afford it, that plonk them into landscapes where they end up spending most of the time in the hotel and not actually getting out and enjoying the biological and landscape assets that are invoked when the words ecotourism are used. And the other side of it, the recreation side, the current worldwide craze on mountain biking and four-wheel driving and quad biking, it's all about what landscapes do you actually pursue those healthy recreational activities. And, the little hills and prominences we have, the suburban bushland areas that you have in Perth, and especially in the hills, are extraordinarily vulnerable to just a single pass by a mountain bike or a quad bike or anything like that. Just consider the granite rocks and the hills that you know and love, Jess. If you ride your mountain bike over the moss swards, the green stuff that's right on the edge of the bare rock,
yes,
and into the herb fields that are full of orchids and endangered species, as it turns out, if you just ride once in winter when that's wet, it'll take decades to recover that one pass. And understandably, I guess, because of the distancing from nature that is prevailing, people don't recognise that riding over a granite rock in Western Australia is fundamentally different from riding over a granite rock in Canada or the USA or Europe, where you're dealing with a post-glacial weedy flora that can bounce back in an instant from major disturbance because it's had glaciers wiping out everything.
It's a very good point. And I think, you know, I see the trail bikes and the mountain bikes, and I know people that do it. I've probably done it in the past, not trail bikes, but mountain bikes. I certainly jog over this stuff. And I just wish there was more restriction around trail bikes, but that's a whole nother focus because otherwise we'll have a million trail bikers on the phone. But I hear what you're saying. Let's go to Michael. He's called in. He's got a view on this. Morning, Michael.
Morning. How are you going?
Well, what did you want to say?
I remember back in the 70s when my dad had built a house in Hammersley. They built the house around the trees and all that. They just sort of said, oh, we'll just cut a couple of trees down just so we can get the house in. Now they just ripped the whole lot up, and that really cheeses me off, you know what I mean?
Michael, you and plenty of others. I'll get a response there from Julian. We've done an episode of Focus on Canopy Cover. This is a huge problem.
It really is, and thanks for the call. Yeah, what we're finding in Perth is it's not only just with greenfield or new suburban development, but in infill development, we're losing much of the urban canopy cover. So local government areas like Bayswater lost 13% of their urban canopy cover in just 3 years due to infill development. And that is because, as you say, there is no statutory protection of mature trees in urban development. So in other cities of the world, and I believe Sydney has some protection of mature trees, development needs to actually work around those constraints, which are not really constraints, they're actually a beautiful thing. In Perth, yes, normally our development will proceed from the bulldozer onwards. And we'll work with a blank slate, kind of terra nullius-like landscape as its kind of foundation. So that's a real issue in infill, but it's also on the edge of the city. So Perth is sprawling into what are called geomorphic wetlands, which is like boggy kind of farmland, which just gets wet during winter. But the problem is to get the houses up above water level, we often bring in 3 or 4 metres worth of sand fill. And of course, in bringing in that sand fill, you completely obliterate the fairly complex hydrological situation, but also the biodiversity. So it is a kind of holocaust for biodiversity, those development models. It's exactly as you say. And historically, we have been better at doing that because I think we weren't trying to do suburbs which were so dense and not trying to do infill, which is so dense. As it gets denser, it gets harder to work around mature trees.
I keep thinking that every single issue we do on Focus almost leads back to infill and these issues of urban sprawl. And it's not deliberate. We're not bringing this up in every show. It's just that it seems that so much is just interconnected here in Perth. And these are issues that all of us need to come to terms with and deal with, I suppose. Stephen, I know that you're a big advocate for learning from the First Nations people, Indigenous people, about the cultural tools that they use in this space to help our biodiversity. Why do they offer so much opportunity for us to learn and how?
Jess, my research program is focused on devising new ways of sustainably living with biodiversity. And it's just first principles. If a group of people have spent 60,000 years on the landscapes in which we now live, every plant, every animal, the landscapes that we have were inherited from their management. And surprisingly, I guess, people have rarely asked the Noongar community about how they would care for country. This is turning around now, especially as Native Title is coming on board and a genuine say in caring for some aspects of countryside are now within the purview of Noongar groups. And I've learnt from my Noongar teachers two things. I'm doing an oral history with a lady here in Albany called Lynette Knapp. And when I ask her to talk about her culture, she starts with two comments about the landscape. And in her language, they're kart and bieliar. Kart is the word for the head, the human head,
yes,
but also for hills or mountains, same word. And bieliar is the same as bieliar wetlands in Perth. That's the name for freshwater bodies. And she said, you've got to care for both. And that's fundamental. The hills are where all the spirits are, where the plants and animals that are really unusual are found and tend to concentrate. The wetlands are the source of life. They're the relatively few fertile pockets of land we have in southwest Australian landscapes, and they should be cared for. So these two things, and if you consider what's happened to the Swan Coastal Plain, the first things that went were the wetlands for agricultural development, and the hills were just regarded as relatively unsuitable for agriculture, so left alone, but in modern times now they remain the few places where you can get out and do things like ride a trail bike or a mountain bike or a four-wheel drive or go and see wildflowers or whatever. So we have to, I think, start rethinking about our fundamental attitudes to landscape. Care for the hills. I'm talking about laterite hills, granite outcrops, high sand plain areas, and that includes the Bassendean Dunes and the Pinjarra Shelf of Perth itself, and care for the wetlands. And if you do that, at least the fundamentals of life are being cared for. The second key learning that Aboriginal Australians practice right across the 250 cultures is usually every individual has at least two totems, or burunga, as they're called by the Noongars, a plant one and an animal one. And this is a very special relationship where your totem becomes you, you become your totem. If your totem animal or plant is in trouble, you're in trouble. You have to fix it just in the same way that you have to get healthy yourself. And that sort of relationship, I think, has wonderful application to today and going into the future in present-day society.
Can you explain that for us? How?
Yeah.
Because you talked yesterday about adopting an animal and a plant which may be more familiar to some listeners. Can you explain more on that for us?
Well, it deals with the challenge of we've got so many species that no single individual, no single school or government department or business can care for them all. It's a community-wide challenge. 8,000 species of native plants, for example. I can't remember the names of more than about 10% of them, let alone understand them. But I can and do care for my two plant totems. So that's the kangaroo paw and eucalyptus caesia is my tree totem.
Beautiful ones.
Out in the wheat belt and the granite rocks. And what I can do and what I have done is try and learn about these species. So understand them. What's been published? Are there Noongar stories? Do Noongar people know about them? And how did they care for them? How did they manage the land on which your totem occurs? Did they do something special? And if your totem is under some form of threat, then you should be an advocate for it. You should be, if it's a plant, at least growing it in your garden, learning how to do that, and then sharing your story. And this is something not only every individual can do, every classroom in schools, every small business, every large business, government agencies, right across sectors of the community, it's possible for each of us to learn something about one or two animals and then do animals and plants and then do something about them.
Well, my plant's easy. It's going to be the spider rocket. So thanks for filling me with a bit of hope there, Stephen.
Good on you, Jess.
Julian, what do you think we can do in terms of, on our everyday level?
Look, I think we require a fundamental shift in mindset. We go back to Septimus Rowe, who drew up the first plan for Perth and laid this grid down next to what has become Perth Water. It was all about dividing the land up into parcels which could be flogged off for real estate. So it's the idea of landscape as commodity or landscape as resource, and that has been a tendency of the Western mindset to see landscape in those terms. And I think we need a kind of spiritual reawakening which understands the land as being more than a resource, more than something that can be commodified and sold off for a bang-for-buck development. We need to be able to see it as sacred. And I think without appropriating Indigenous knowledge or spirituality, I think there is an example there of how the landscape is a sacred thing, a sacred text, I think, which we can learn from more broadly to kind of try and shift away from this default mindset, which is land is a commodity.
Beautifully said. Stephen?
Yeah, I'm right with you, Julian. And the issue of appropriation is important. So in doing, changing the mindset, for me, the personal transformation has been talking with Noongars, asking them if is it possible for a white fella to learn about aspects of their culture that they wish to share, and can we walk together? And that is the fundamental learning exercise that I've become aware of with Noongar culture. So getting out and walking is the way you experience environments, and you learn from people you're walking with, and you learn about the environment just by watching elders and people who understand this stuff and how they operate. That underpinned PAF's opening event, the Borna Wongan Festival that happened in Kings Park earlier this year.
It sounded fantastic. I missed it, but I really wanted to go, and I know a lot of people listening today would have gone.
A beautiful experience. Four nights and 230,000 people experienced it, and it was based on the simple concept of people from the community, all walks, all colours, all religions, walking and stopping at six points along the way in Kings Park, learning about what's special about these landscapes right in the heart of the city and the broader state, southwest in particular, and then learning about traditional knowledge that can be shared and is a gift to all of us, and what science is teaching us, learning about the extinction crisis, which this report, international report, is about, but then the message of hope at the end, the things you can do, beautifully illustrated by primary school kids from about 50 schools who created lanterns which celebrated the totems they'd decided to adopt.
I can't wait for that to come back. I really did. I was very upset I missed that one. Stephen, John has called in and he's got a question for you, I think, about feral cats. Good morning, John.
Look, feral animals of all shapes and sizes, cats, foxes, pigs, camels, goats. Western Australia, we're riddled with them. And I just want to know if Steve's got any magic ideas as a society what we should do to control them better. I know DBCA and others do a damn fine job using 1080 poison, but look, those guys have done untold damage to our fauna in particular and our general biodiversity. So, Steve, looking for some magic ideas, my friend.
Over to you, Steve.
I wish I had the magic bullet, John. I think Julian sort of hit the nail on the head in saying it. Ultimately, it's going to require mainstream learning, I guess, from Aboriginal people about we are connected, even though it seems often distantly in the city, we are connected intimately with what's outside, with the sky, the land, and the plants and animals that live on it. And we are the custodians of something truly remarkable from an international point of view. If that value system comes up, then and people do things like adopt animal totems, straight away they'll run into the feral problem, not only animals but the weeds and dieback disease. And for each of them, the science has been prosecuted well enough for us to understand what's going on. And it comes down to responsible custodianship, I guess. So feral cats, big problem. Domestic cats are a source of feral cats, so responsible cat ownership, you know, is fundamental that every urban person who wants to have a cat can do. Same with dogs. Foxes and, you know, some animals, we're blessed in the southwest in having a tremendously long evolutionary period where poison peas evolved in the southwest and the native fauna became relatively resistant to the poison, whereas introduced fauna like foxes and cats and the like, pigs are not resistant. So 1080 poison is a boon we can spread across the landscape and know that we're knocking off the ferals selectively, and most natives are okay. The other big thing that's happened, I guess, has been the third sector, the emergence of fenced enclosures, where it's been demonstrated that if you get rid of the ferals, then all sorts of wonderful animals and plants and new relationships can be re-established. So Karaka Maya in the hills of Perth is an example. The Australian Wildlife Conservancy established. Bush Heritage Australia is doing lots of stuff now that the increasingly hard-pressed government departments with declining budgets and staff are finding difficult to do.
Good to hear that the NGOs are stepping in a bit. I'm going to just move on to a couple more texts, Stephen, because we've been asking people what they do this morning. Morning, Jess. I worked for over 15 years for Men of the Trees, growing and planting native trees and shrubs throughout WA. I now work part-time for my son, whose offices were built on a bear paddock in West Swan Road. That area is now filled with a mixture of native and deciduous trees. I've planted since 2000 and the bird life is extraordinary and enjoyed by everyone. We've also dumped all plastic cups and water bottles and have an Enviro watch notice board, keeping everyone informed as to what they can do. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Dee. That's a lovely text. And there's plenty of people from the Perth Hills texting in today. We're facing the destruction of the Perth Hills, which is a biodiversity hotspot because of urbanisation. The greatest threat to the Perth Hills is high-density housing developers who do not respect the environment. Lots and lots of texts along that similar theme today. So I don't know if there's, you know, lobby groups out there, you know, community groups that are activating because they don't like what they're hearing, but certainly very interesting. Julian, we're touching on what we can all do in terms of, you know, helping out this issue around biodiversity and losing these beautiful species here in Western Australia. But quite often when you talk about things like taking action on climate change or whatever, people say, oh, well, what's the point? What's the point of me doing this in my world when, you know, the likes of fast-growing nations, India and China, with their massive growing consumer populations, is that something that, you know, we do find hard to, I suppose, counter?
Yeah, I think there's a risk with this that you become paralysed in the face of the kind of projections and data that you hear around species loss. But I think you can flip that on its head too. There's never been a more exciting time to be alive in many respects. There's plenty of challenges that can get you out of bed in the morning. And I think it's just a matter of picking them and really going for it. But from my perspective, we are in a period which offers an unparalleled kind of creative opportunity. Now, I'm talking as an urban designer here, but I think this encompasses the scene more generally. You know, like by 2030, there's going to be 1.2 million square kilometres of new urban development around the world, it is projected. Perth's population is going to increase to 6.6 million people by 2061, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And globally, we'll go to 11 billion by 2100. So this period of growth and crisis that we're in now will not last forever. And it, you know, as it relates to population growth, it's predicted to stabilise at that point. So we're at a point where we can, the kind of patterns, the urban patterns and patterns of biodiversity we established now will endure. And so it's really important we get it right. But I think it's important that we engage this challenge in a way that we don't get paralysed, that we are positive and that we are creative about it. Because if we don't believe we can do it, then we're truly stuffed.
I actually love how you sum that up. We are getting quite a few texts in. So people do care about this issue. People genuinely care, not just Hills people. People from across the city here are sending texts in wanting to have their say. Tanya Steinbeck from the CEO of the Urban Development Institute. Morning, Tanya. She says, we're fully supportive of the strategic assessment of Perth and Peel, the green growth plan being implemented. Developers want to create sustainable communities but are regularly challenged by local council approvals and other risks such as bushfire that results in suboptimal outcomes. The medium density design code needs to address retention of key biodiversity assets to retain tree canopies. That is, yep, thanks for that. It's good to get, you know, the flip side to that. This one, Susan says, hi, Jess, we lost our bushland opposite Shenton College to more houses and apartments. We must save the UWA Underwood Ave bushland. There will be no corridors left for wildlife. I have a quenda and frogs in my very small front yard just off Hay Street in Jollymont. Great info today. And great info always comes from great guests. So my big thanks to both of our guests today. I can't read out all of the texts and get to all of the calls because there's quite simply too many. So big thanks to Dr. Julian Bolliter, the Acting Director of the Australian Urban Design Research Centre at the University of Western Australia, and Professor of Biodiversity at UWA, Stephen Hopper, who was joining us from the ABC's studios in beautiful Albany. And you'll all remember him from his days up there at King's Park, where there's, I mean, it's just one of our, it's the jewel in the crown. We all love it and we all enjoy it. So a big thanks to them, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion. I hope you like this song.
I came from the dream time, from the dusty red soil plains. I am the ancient heart, the keeper of the flame.
I stood upon the rocky shore, I watched the tall ships come. For 40,000 years I've been first Australia.
I'm a teller of stories, I'm a singer of songs, I am up and I'm a giraffe, I paint the ghostly gums.
I am Clancy on his horse, I made Kelly on the run.
I'm the one who wants Matilda, I am Australia.